Welcome and good afternoon to this last session or last official session for the day. The topic for the next 50 minutes is the official topic, at least, apps versus sites versus content. And the only reason is really because Jeff wanted some sort of a catchphrase for the official session title. Really what it is about is the subtitle, a vendor agnostic view on building stuff for the mobile web. So the idea of this talk is actually not to, you know, show you how to build something from a technology point of view. The idea is really a primer for people who are interested in moving from web development or moving from desktop development and build something that works on mobile. And to have a look into different technologies, different mobile platforms, different delivery mechanisms, and into potential ways to actually earn some money from that as well, if you know, if you wish to do so. So that's some sort of the, you know, what we want to achieve. What does that mean? The agenda really will be 5 or 6 points. We'll have a look back into history a little bit and, you know, just to get an idea what mobile development and mobile device used to be a few years ago. Then we'll talk about mobile platforms. So what are the most common mobile platforms you would want to make your application or your content work for? How to code against those platforms? Then we'll have a bit of a chat about what to build and particularly which platform to build it for, how to make money with it, and we'll try to predict the future, which is a fun task in itself, actually. So a quick word about myself. My name is Kai Koenig. I live in Wellington in New Zealand. And I spend lots of my time doing technology consulting. Lots of that work is based on the Adobe platform. So I do a lot of work with Flash, Flash Platform, Flex, Air, things like lifecycle PDF documents. But I'm also an Apple fanboy and an Adobe fanboy, as that says, basically. I don't like Windows very much. But I'll try to be very neutral when it comes to Windows on mobile, as you might see in a few minutes. And I'm quite interested in weird programming languages. So let's start with going back in history. Back then. Anyone see something familiar on that slide? Yeah, okay. A few people would probably. So this is the typical history of a mobile early adopter growing up in Germany in the mid-90s. That's me, actually. So the phone in the left upper left corner, that was my first cell phone. And it was called Handy Dance, for whatever reason. It doesn't even have a brand. E-Plus is actually the network operator. When you look at it today, it was probably like that high and like that thick, right? And the only feature besides being used as a phone was it could receive text messages. It couldn't send text messages. Why would it? You know, but receiving text messages, that's fine, not a problem at all. If you have a look at all the other pictures, you'll see a few interesting things, right? And there's some sort of a showcase how mobile phones in mid-late 90s to early 2000s developed, basically. You'll see it goes from very classic phone models, like this Nokia up here, or this typical business Nokia phone here, to phones that are quite nicely designed, like this one. Super tiny and look quite posh, actually. And it ends up with a phone where you, looking at it today, think, what did the designer of this phone smoke? Right? Because this thing here, Nokia 3650, had the keys arranged in a circle. And you think, like, why the hell would you do that? You know, back in the day, apparently that was the one of the things they experimented with. This phone, actually, that one in the corner here with the round circle of keys, was one of the first Symbian S60 phones. And we're going to come back to that in a few minutes, actually, because Symbian S60 is one of the most common mobile phone operating systems still today, believe it or not. The other thing to note, pretty much all of those phones are Nokia phones. And that's an interesting thing in itself, because what it means is back then, Nokia was massive. You had a Nokia phone, you were cool. You had a Siemens phone, it was like, you know, why would you have a Siemens phone? That's just boring old stuff, right? Nowadays, today, we look at mobile phones and we think like, oh, that person has a Nokia phone? Oh my God, that's so last millennium, you know? So, next slide. That's similar history, right? Personal history of Kai's gadgets. Those are actually all the PDAs I owned over the last few years, or, well, it's quite way back, actually. Mostly Pocket PC, which is a very, very early version of what we today see as Windows Mobile 7 or Windows Phone 7. This is a Sony Ericsson that was one of the first touch screens on a phone, believe it or not. And you had to use a little pen to actually operate it. And that's just a more modern Nokia phone, pretty much. Why I'm showing those images and those photos is basically to lead into this. About 8 years ago, a conference happened here in Sydney called MXDU, which was some sort of, you know, the first WebDU, really, back in the day. And I presented at that conference about developing web applications for mobile devices using CodeFusionMX. And I want to show you four extracts of those old slides to make it clear how the perception of developing for mobile devices has changed over the years. So up in the upper left corner, we see at that time there used to be three types of mobile devices. Cellular phones, ooh, wow. PDAs, anyone still owns a PDA nowadays? Just wondering. Okay, it's pretty much zero. And smartphones, wow, hybrid devices. Ooh, gosh, awesome. Smartphones, fairly new market. And you see this one here? That was a Pocket PC with a phone module integrated. The battery lasted about 2 hours, then it was dead. But you know, was a cool thing. The two dominating PDA platforms, Palm OS and Pocket PC or Windows CE at the time. Anyone, you know, has heard anything of Pocket PC or Windows CE recently? Not really. Palm OS is still around, but it has morphed into something like, which is called Web OS, Palm Web OS, and it's a more modern version of having an operating system on a PDA. And I mean, there are no Palms around anymore anyway. It's a phone with PDA functionality now. And then coming to developing for mobile devices, that was one of the examples I showed. It's a super stupid order form rendered for a normal web browser in a Pocket PC, and then some magic happened to use XML and XSLT to transform it into something that renders more nicely on a Pocket PC. And that was pretty much the maximum at that time that, you know, we did when it came to mobile, because it was just not there yet. Even though, you know, looking at companies like Nokia or Microsoft or Adobe, and everyone was telling you at that stage, mobile is the next big thing, right? And now 8 years later, everyone is still telling you mobile is the next big thing, with the difference that actually now it might happen. 8 years ago, certainly it didn't happen because the best you could do was WAP. And have you ever built a WAP page or WAP application with like, oh, I don't even want to go there. It's just shocking. So at that time, J2ME was big, Java 2 Mobile Edition. And that is still big on some phone platforms nowadays. Buying content, which we all probably do through iTunes or Android Marketplace nowadays, was a pain in the neck. There were like probably 20 different little online stores where you could buy stuff. Each of those stores had an individual mechanism to invoice you, where you had to pay through credit card or bank transfer, then you got your application 3 days later or something like that. Totally crazy. Or you had to, you know, send a premium text to Vodafone or whatever company you were with, and they pushed you the Java application via WAP onto your phone. Really not great. Another problem with J2ME particularly, you have installation issues and you have compatibility issues. Because J2ME as a platform is not the same on every phone. you've got scenarios in which phone A and phone B both run officially J2ME, but they have different screen resolutions, they support different mobile profiles, and at the end of the day, as a developer for J2ME, you had to pretty much test your application in 30 emulators or 30 phones to really, you know, make sure that it works all over the place. Today, it's a bit different. People like the, or organizations like the Wired magazine basically say the web is dead, meaning that the amount of web traffic is decreasing and that the amount of app traffic driven by applications on mobile devices is increasing. There are variations of that. Some people say mobile is the new standard, or don't design for desktop, design for mobile, or to empower people through great software anytime, any place, and on any device. Does anyone know who that last one is from?
You.
Hmm? No, not me. It's actually from a famous person. Bill Gates, about 10 years ago, way before before the time of, you know, mobile actually, but he had that idea to make it work, that people can use software wherever they are on a device that, you know, suits them pretty much. What we're seeing now is basically an app revolution, realistically. The way how people interact with services changes dramatically. From going to a website to, at least in certain areas, having an app, and the app is doing whatever it needs to present the stuff you want to see. The question is, what changed that? And I'm pretty sure everyone would know the answer to that, because it was this. Well, not specifically this. It was actually the iPhone 1, pretty much. Or rather, the iPhone 3G that changed it, because the iPhone 3G was really the first platform where we had an app store, where we could, in a really easy way, go to an application and buy stuff for our mobile, right? Before that, even with the iPhone 1, that was hardly possible. Just out of interest, how many people here have an iPhone or an iOS device? Okay, how many people have an Android phone? So apparently there are people who have two phones, right? Who has both? Okay, just two, fine. Anyone has a phone which is not Android or iOS? Just a few random picks. What do you have?
Nokia 97.
Okay. Someone over there? Okay. Anyone has a smartphone which is not Android or iOS? Okay. So you are the minority, clearly. Which is, you know, it doesn't have to be a bad thing, because there are reasonably good smartphone platforms out there which are not Android or iOS. For example, Palm or Windows Mobile or BlackBerry, you know, typical things. But the iPhone changed our perception of mobile phones. If that's justified or not, that's just the reality, basically. Why? Because Apple believed in a very innovative concept, touchscreen, having some sort of icons on a touchscreen that you can, you know, touch and do stuff with. Apple had a delivery mechanism in place at the right time, at the right place, basically, because lots of people had iTunes. They just thought, well, you know, we've got iTunes, people buy music, people buy other stuff. Why don't we just sell apps through that and make a hell of money? And that worked out quite well for them. So when we look at mobile platforms, there's obviously Apple iOS. So as that little, you know, random poll has shown, in certain communities, the amount of people having iOS devices is huge, and particularly in developer and design communities. So, I mean, that's clearly shown here. When we look at the phones or the devices running iOS, we've got iPhones, we've got iPad 1 and 2 now, and we've got iPod Touch in a certain configuration, basically. I never owned an iPod Touch, and I never coded anything for it specifically, so I couldn't really tell you which version of an iPod Touch runs which iOS version, but iPod Touch in general is the normal iOS. Quite realistically, there are four different major releases of iOS, 1 to 4. And technically, they should be all out there in the wild. In reality, I think you will be hard-pressed to find a device with iOS 1 nowadays. You will most likely find that there are about 90% of iPhone users using iOS 4, and about 10% still using iOS 3. And those 10% are basically usually people who own an iPhone 3G or an iPhone 1 who couldn't make the upgrade to iOS 4 or didn't want to because of the performance issues. And statistics of, you know, on websites or online shops or even Apple show pretty much that distribution. 90% have moved on to iOS 4, 10% stayed on iOS 3, and a marginal number on older versions. That's a good thing, because what it means is when you develop for iOS, you can quite easily rely on a certain feature set. And you can obviously rely on a certain hardware, right? So you can pretty much assume that your user base will have one of two defined screen resolutions. There will be those particular hardware features available. There will be particular, you know, APIs available for your application, et cetera, et cetera. It's quite easy to build an iOS app that works across the vast majority of your target devices. iOS itself is based on the OS X kernel. So it's actually a Unix operating system. Apple is quite interested in having full control of iOS, which is the typical Apple model. They give you the hardware, they give you the operating system, and it works together quite nicely. So that's fine. The next one, Google Android, is a bit different. With Android, we'll see there are a variety of device manufacturers. Probably HTC is the largest one in numbers at the moment, but Samsung, Motorola, LG are catching up quite nicely. Google doesn't focus on hardware as such. They have two phones, the Google Nexus 1 and the Google Nexus S, which has been released quite recently. But the Google Nexus 1 is actually an HTC phone behind the scenes, and the Nexus S is actually a Samsung phone. So Google is not building their own phones. But what that shows us is when we talk about Android, we have to deal with fragmentation on the hardware side of things. And that's not just based on hardware, it's also based on software. What you'll find is Android is not Android. So there is Android 1.5, 1.6. There is Android 2.0, 2.1, 2.2, 2.3, and 3.0 in the make. And the problem with that is they are significantly different. When you take a device with Android 1.5 or 1.6, it's, in terms of usability from a user's point of view, and also in terms of coding against it, a totally different ballgame than coding against Android 2.2, which is some sort of what I personally consider the minimum of what I want to work with, really. And that leads to problems, because the average customer buying an iOS device is quite often someone who's interested in a slick phone that works, that often works nicely with your Mac, where you don't have any issues, or hopefully, you know, sometimes you have issues, obviously. But the average Android phone purchaser is someone who wants a smartphone. And research shows that people who buy Android phones don't care that much about, is it a Samsung, an LG, a Motorola? They want Android. They want to have a smartphone which allows them to run apps, to maintain their contacts, to use Twitter, Facebook, blah, 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 blah. And when I ask among my non-geek friends who have smartphones, basically, lots of people will be able to tell me, oh, it's an Android phone. But if I asked, oh, is it Froyo or is it Gingerbread or something like that, I get a blank stare because they have no clue and they wouldn't want to have a clue and they shouldn't really. But from a developer's point of view, that leads to an issue that we have to deal with lots of different versions of the operating system out there. Android as an operating system is open source, so that makes it quite different from iOS. It's based on a Linux kernel, which is a good thing, and it's quite stable, actually. And what you find is Google doesn't want to have control over over Android as Apple wants over iOS, but network operators and device manufacturers want to have a lot of control. So if you basically end up buying a Samsung phone or even an HTC phone, you don't get the native Android. You get a flavored version of Android that Samsung thought would be appropriate for you, right? So you buy a Samsung phone, let's say you get it with Android 2.1 or 2.2, for example. You want to upgrade that phone to Android 2.3, which I have done with my Google phone about 3 months ago. You need to wait until Samsung decides what's good for you. Or you jailbreak or root your phone. You know, jailbreak in the Apple world, rooting your phone is the equivalent in the Android world, basically. Obviously, rooting your phone, yeah, I know. No pun intended. It's just what people call it. Sorry. Basically, rooting your phone leads to... Oh, come on, people. Seriously. It's not that funny. Basically, it leads to losing your warranty, right? So many people wouldn't want to do that. But on the same end, people don't want to wait have to wait 6 months until they get, you know, whatever Samsung wants to do to Android 2.3 to get it, or 3.0. So if you want to stay legal, basically, or, you know, keep your warranty up and running, but also you want to have the latest version of the operating system, your best bet is to get a Google phone, to be quite frank. Then there is Symbian OS. Symbian OS is interesting because it is legally consortium driven. So it's an organization, the Symbian Foundation or something like that, that owns Symbian, and they maintain the development and the future of Symbian. Well, if there is a future, that's a different story. Really, the major driver behind Symbian OS is Nokia, or used to be Nokia. Symbian comes in three flavors. There is S60, which is short for Sirius 60. And you'll find a lot of the Nokia smarter phones from around 2002-03 to 2008-09 run on Symbian S60. Then there is UIQ, which is a Symbian version for touchscreens. And that Sony Ericsson phone I showed earlier with that flip keyboard, that is actually a Symbian UIQ phone. And then there is MOAP, which is a Symbian version that is not really relevant for anyone who is outside of Japan, because that's a Symbian flavor that's used by NTT Docomo for all those funky Japanese phones. So Symbian is not dead. Don't get me wrong on that. It's free of charge. It's alive and kicking because there are lots, ridiculously huge amounts of Nokia phones or other phones running Symbian out there. If you want to develop for Symbian, that's a different story, and we'll come to that in a few minutes. Another funny quote, and I've put that into a TUI ad, which New Zealanders might actually get, the few New Zealanders in the first row, actually. To explain that, TUI is a beer company in New Zealand, and they have some sort of an ad series where they put some really weird statement onto a big billboard, and then that, yeah, right. So this one says, there's no chance that the iPhone is going to get any significant market share. No chance. Any idea who did say that?
Steve Jobs.
No, it was actually Steve Ballmer in 2007. So the iPhone was pretty much just released, and he said, no, it's not going to work. No, not at all. Right. That leads us to the success story of Windows Mobile for phones. So the problem with Windows Mobile for phones is Microsoft lacks a strategy. And I'm not saying that, you know, with bitterness or anything. It is just the truth. And if you attended WebDU in the previous years, you might have come across that lack of strategy within, or mobile strategy within Microsoft, by attending those breakfast mobile phone presentations where they basically every year showed a totally different concept of what they think a mobile Windows should be. There's literally no consistency. And again, with Windows Phone 7, there is a totally new approach. They basically threw away everything they had up to now and redid it. And there is hope that this approach is going to work better because they basically said, look, we had, before Windows Phone 7, we had such a huge amount of fragmentation where people basically licensed our operating system and did to it whatever they want on a Palm phone, on an HTC phone. I think there was even a German Telekom T-Mobile phone running Windows or something like that. And they wanted to basically break out of that. And I said, look, we are redoing this. And we are basically prescribing for Windows Phone 7 what the specs of a Windows Phone 7 phone have to be. And we'll come to that in a few minutes as well when we look at the development approaches. Basically, it means if you want to release a phone and run Windows Phone 7 on it, it has to be exactly a certain display resolution. It has to be at minimum a 1 gigahertz CPU. It has to have so and so many RAMs, main memory, so and so many gigabyte RAM, flash memory, et cetera, et cetera. That's a good thing because it will lead to a certain level of spec that people get in a Windows 7 phone. The other thing that might be really interesting for developers, it is using sort of a best of breed of Microsoft technologies. So if you're into that, if you're into doing .NET and Silverlight and XAML and all that stuff, then Windows Phone 7 is probably actually a good platform to code for. Then there are a few others. Palm Web OS. Yeah. It's interesting. It's not dead. It's alive and kicking on Palm devices. And there are talks that we might see WebOS on some other devices in the future, like TVs, for example. I'm not quite sure if that's going to happen. Then there is Nokia Memo, rest in peace, dead. Because Nokia, if you haven't heard, is pretty much at the end of their mobile strategy. And they had to pretty much resort to getting Microsoft in to supply Windows Phone 7 because Nokia has really lost the plot when it comes to smartphones. There was an approach of a thing called MeeGo, which is a Linux-based operating system using Qt as a UI library. So for all the Linux freaks, that would have been really cool. But again, Nokia has totally missed the train. And they have a new CEO who's actually an ex-Microsoft exec. And before that, he used to be the CEO of Macromedia, Stephen Elop. Quite funny, whole thing worked. But he basically said, look, this is not going to work. We throw away pretty much Symbian for new phones. We throw away the MeeGo thing because it's not going to go anywhere. We are going to partner with Microsoft and we'll run Windows Phone 7 on our smartphones. And that is an approach that could work quite well because traditionally Windows Phone 7 or Windows Mobile had its biggest market share in the US, and that's some sort of a market Nokia really needs to target to get back onto their feet. There's another thing, LIMO Foundation, Linux on Mobile Foundation, not quite sure what's going on there, and then there's BlackBerry OS, which is quite big as a platform in sheer numbers, so lots of people have a BlackBerry, obviously, but the app or developing apps community for BlackBerry is rather small. I don't know, who has a BlackBerry of you guys? Two people? Do you have any third-party apps on it, or many third-party apps? So, but not really in a large scale, I would assume. Yeah, that's what you find quite often, because BlackBerries are used as enterprise corporate devices. So either people are not allowed to install stuff, or they're not really interested because they use it for email. It's just not the traditional device to play games on or do social networking or something like that. Oh, sorry, one thing I wanted to say to BlackBerry. It will actually change in the future because they have released a new BlackBerry called BlackBerry Torch last year. And they are also releasing a tablet called Playbook. Actually, next week, I think. And there is some hope that those two platforms will actually revive that research in motion BlackBerry app development market. The BlackBerry Playbook tablet, in particular, is going to use Adobe Air as one of its main development environments. So if you want to build something for the Playbook tablet, you will pretty much have to build it in AIR. So when it comes to coding for mobile, as always, there are lots of options. And the first option you could go with is native. And native basically means you use the SDK or development environment of whoever or whatever platform you want to code for and build an app that compiles and runs on that platform. So for example, iOS. So for iOS native development, you need the iOS or the iPhone SDK, and you are most likely to develop in an environment called Xcode. For people on Windows, or mainly more people who use Windows as their main platform, you might probably say, can I do that in Visual Studio? No, you can't. iOS SDK or iPhone SDK is Mac only. So if you want to build something natively for iPhone or iPad, you need to own a Mac. That is all true for iOS version 2 and upwards. In iOS version 1, there was no SDK. The only way to get custom applications onto the early iPhones was actually to build a web app, pretty much. The language you're coding in will be Objective-C, or C for some libraries, based on the Cocoa framework. And the Cocoa framework is pretty much used for when you build native Mac apps as well. So it's that whole theme to get developers for the Mac platform onto the iOS platform. It's a really well-supported environment. It's also well-controlled by Apple. You know, don't use any custom third-party APIs or undocumented APIs, because otherwise your app might not actually make it into the App Store. And it also mentions that separation between iOS 4 and iOS 3. What you will find as a common theme when it comes to native development is you get some sort of an IDE, which is an editor or a UI builder or something like that. You'll get a compiler, and you get a device emulator. And that is something you will usually find in all the scenarios we talk about. So iOS, in particular, gives you four layers. And it starts at the bottom with stuff like CoreOS, which is file system security, the Unix kernel, et cetera, et cetera. Then you've got a few core services on top of that. And they are usually C libraries. On top of those, you've got a media API and Cocoa Touch, which is the UI framework and the framework at the top of the food chain, basically. And they are mostly Objective-C, but there are some C libraries among them as well. When we look at Android, we'll find that we'll code in Java. So that's quite cool for people who know Java, obviously. But it doesn't run on a JVM. What Google did is they said, well, the normal JVM doesn't really suit what we want to do on a mobile phone. So we come up with something called Dalvik VM. So it's a virtual machine that accepts your Java code or your compiled Java code for Android and runs it in a special environment on your phone. To code for Android, you need the Android SDK. And there's basically the way they package it is you download a wrapper Android SDK, and then you download plugins for the Android versions you want to code against. Usually that's Eclipse-based. There is a variety of APIs. It can become tricky sometimes if you want to build something that works across all the different Android releases. Because even if, you know, like I said before, if you look at a step from 2 to 2.1, or from 2.1 to 2.2, they are actually major releases. They are not like mini dot releases like Apple is doing. They have a lot of change usually. The other thing is the fragmentation of Android versions. I'm not quite sure how well this can be read. Oh, that's actually quite good. You'll see that's actually data I got from the Android market. They release the versions of Android people used to download apps from the Android market basically every week for the 2 weeks before that. And that's a few, like 2 or 3 weeks old, that graphic. But you see that the vast majority, and that's a good thing, is on Android 2.2. But there's also a huge amount of Android 2.1 users. And you have to bridge that gap. Android 3.0, that's tiny, because the only way to run that at the moment is to build it yourself, hack your phone, like rooting it, and installing a custom build of Android 3.0, basically. So the fragmentation in Android is significant, but it's not dramatic. If you choose, for example, to ignore Android 1.5 and 1.6, well, you know, it makes your life much, much easier, and you lose about 10% of your installation base. Let me just have a look at the numbers. Not even 10%. It would be about 8%. That's something that might be a trade-off that's, you know, feasible to do. Symbian OS is quite fun in itself, because there is no really prescribed SDK or development environment. You get SDKs, which are usually command line SDKs, and you just code with whatever IDE you want. You can code in C++, Java, or Python, which is quite cool. Actually, Python for Symbian OS is very entertaining, and it's, I mean, in a positive way, you know? Not in a negative way, because it's actually really fun to code against it. There are a few issues with the operating system flavors, that something you code for Sirius 60 will never ever run on UIQ without major changes, and vice versa. There are many different hardware profiles around. So even with, if you decide to do something for Sirius 60, the way they basically sell it is you get like the fourth edition, feature pack 7. And then in feature pack 8, they basically apply a whole new set of things, and you have to relearn major stuff from scratch. And people, users, phone users, can usually not upgrade Symbian OS on their phone. That means if you buy a Nokia N93, it comes with a certain version of Sirius 60, that user is stuck with that until they throw away the phone and buy a new one, basically. And that's obviously, when you compare it to iOS and Android, a huge drawback, okay? And then we have Windows Phone 7. And even though I'm not a Windows fan, I have to say the Windows Phone 7 story is reasonably compelling. So basically, you get a free IDE, Visual Studio Express for Windows Phone. You get Expression Blend for Windows Phone, which is a sort of a design tool-y thing. Or if you have an existing Visual Studio anyway, you can get those as a plugin. There is C# and VB.NET support. C# is available both in the plugin for your commercial IDE and in the free version. VB.NET support was released 2 months ago, but just as a plugin for an existing Visual Studio. And they basically said they are going to embed that into the Express version at some stage, but the last time I checked, it wasn't there yet. The development approach is XAML, Silverlight, and XNA. XAML and Silverlight are two technologies that Microsoft introduced originally as a flash killer. So they try to basically have something that is, you know, a direct competitor of flash in the web. It didn't quite work out that well for Microsoft. Basically, I think they pretty much lost that war. So they decided, well, we can't really throw Silverlight away. Let's make it the new mobile phone platform. And that's a fair approach, I think, because people have invested into Silverlight and into XAML. And it seems as if it is a good platform to build UIs. Obviously, when you decide to go with Windows Phone, you expect that they push their Windows APIs onto you. It is quite promising because they have the deal with Nokia. So all the new Nokia smartphones will come with Windows Phone 7. And it goes well with the whole Microsoft stack. Just in a quick overview, the way it works in there is you have a common base class library, which is basically your .NET layer. On top of that, you've got Silverlight for presentation or for video stuff. And you've got XMA and XNA. And XNA is actually a library and a technology that comes from the Xbox. And that is quite cool, because if you want to develop games for Windows Phone 7, that will allow you to build stunning 3D games on those phones. So that library is really, really good. And on top of that are the specific Phone 7 APIs. And then there is RIM, BlackBerry, and I'm not going deeply into that. It's basically Java, a bunch of custom APIs, a rather complicated tooling. So they are not quite, at least with the old BlackBerry stuff, they are not really quite up to scratch with Xcode or Eclipse. And the deployment mechanism is quite odd because everything that BlackBerry does goes through their server infrastructure, and it's just weird. So instead of native, we could also do web. When we build something for the phones via the web, we just need to have a think about why that works in the first place. And the reason, the only reason is, with the first iPhones, you couldn't build apps. So basically everyone jumped onto building custom web apps for the first iPhone. And then things like mobile JavaScript libraries or mobile CSS frameworks appeared, and people needed to make them successful to build stuff for their phones or for, you know, users of the iPhone 1. It was basically a make or break thing. Either we make that work, or we won't have apps, or you have to jailbreak your phone, which not everyone would like to do. I'm deeply convinced that the limitations of iOS 1 in terms of custom app development are what caused what we know as Ajax-based mobile apps today to be successful in the first place. That's the only sole reason. If the iOS 1 wasn't that limited, basically, we wouldn't see that mobile JavaScript infrastructure today. I think developing in JavaScript and HTML for mobile phones is sort of grown up by now. So the good thing is, you can, if you're a web developer, you can leverage your skills. You can just build your apps in what you know. And there are quite cool frameworks out there. There's jQuery Touch. There's jQuery Mobile, which is now also embedded into Dreamweaver, which is quite cool. There's Sencha Touch. There are tons of others. There are a variety of CSS libraries to skin your app to look like an iPhone or to look like a typical Android app or whatever you like, really, right? If you want to do that, it's fairly easy to do that. The driver behind that is WebKit, because all the major phones, doesn't matter if it's Android or iOS or even Series 60 or Nokias, is using WebKit as a rendering engine. And then there's obviously stuff like the storage APIs, the local storage, geolocation, file caching, which allow you to build something that feels like a native app as a web app and deploy it quite easily to people's phones. And the third major option of building and deploying stuff is cross-platform. And cross-platform is something that I personally find quite promising. You could, for example, code with Flash and Air. So it's by design cross-platform, obviously. As soon as you have a Flash player, it works. As soon as you have the Air runtime somewhere, it works. There was that big thing about that time last year where Apple said, oh, no, look, we are locking out any app that is built with a third-party technology from our app stores. And the Flash CS5 to iOS packager that came in Creative Suite 5 was sort of quite badly hit by that. Now that has changed. Obviously, you know, Apple tries to sell that change of mind through saying, well, actually, you know, we tested it and we think developers want more freedom, blah, blah, blah. The reality is the European Union started an antitrust investigation against Apple because they locked off their phone that badly. And then Apple had to prove something to provide a bit more openness to let other platform or let developers build apps with other platforms for their phone. Today we'll find Flash Player 10 in various versions and Air 2.5 or 2.6 on Android phones. That is really cool. And it works quite well, actually. Air is also one of the major development platforms for the playbook. And we'll get Flex for mobile mid-2011. So for the people who don't know what Flex is, it's basically a development framework for developing Flash platform apps without using the Flash authoring animation environment. So it's Flash for coders, if you want to. So that's quite cool for Flash platform developers, because you can just build content and build apps and deploy it to phones. There's also another thing called Flash Lite, which is a profile of a Flash player, which is very, very lightweight. And it used to be quite, or it is still big in Japan or in other Asian countries. It never really took off in Western countries for a variety of reasons. And some of the reasons are network operators, because they had to install it on their phones. It took ages to get the new player version out, and it was just painful. So the Flash player on devices, depending on the device and the platform, you get 10, 10.1, 10.2. Molehill, the 3D stuff we've seen this morning in the keynote, will be out there at some stage as well. So then you can start to build really cool 3D or GPU accelerated apps on phones. It is, from my point of view, really awesome for game development. And it's really cool because you can, if you're a Flash or Flex developer, you can use lots of your existing libraries in code to build apps for devices, whatever that device might be, a tablet or, you know, a phone. Then we have Air on devices. Air 2.x was basically the first release of Air that worked on not on non-desktop environments. We are now at 2.6, 2.7, I think is in beta or is announced. It works even on iOS, so you can, you know, use Flash or Flash Builder, package your Swift as an iOS app, and that uses behind the scenes some sort of parts of Air. The apps install as native apps in Android or in iOS, so you can sell them through the App Store. Quite cool. Then there are two more platforms. One is Titanium, and the other one is PhoneGap. The idea of both is very similar. It's you write something in your language, which is usually JavaScript for those platforms, and you compile or package it in a way that it works as a native app on Android and iOS. Titanium is quite cool because it actually literally creates a native app, and you code it purely in JavaScript. PhoneGap is a bit differently. PhoneGap uses HTML, CSS, and JS. And what they do is they wrap your web code into a web wrapper in whatever native format it is. So basically what you get here is, on iOS, a web view component packaged as an iOS app that actually contains all the HTML, JavaScript, CSS files. Whereas in Titanium, you literally get an app, which is a native app, that has been just coded with JavaScript. But you don't have just a web wrapper around it. The next question is what to build, and which of those platforms should you choose? The problem with that is, I don't know. That's just the reality, you know. The only people who can answer that question are basically your customers, or your employer, or it might be yourself if you want to sell something on an app store. Some ideas that might help you to make a decision could be, for example, what is it that you want to do? Is it a mobile presence? Like, do you have an existing website, let's say an online shop? You're selling, I don't know, accessories for pets, like little dog beds or something. And you realize that more and more people use tablets when they go online instead of PCs. Do you build an iOS app or an Android app or both, or even a BlackBerry app to sell your dog beds or dog toys, whatever? Probably you wouldn't. Probably you would make your website work for those mobile devices. So you would build a new skin for your existing web application. And that's fairly easy to do by jQuery Mobile, PhoneGap, JQ Touch, whatever, you name it. Other examples might be you want to develop a game. If you are familiar with iOS, you're an Objective-C coder anyway, use Objective-C, build a game, that's cool. If you are a Flash developer, you might think, well, I could just use Flash and then deploy my game on 3-4 different platforms without having to do major changes. So that's, you know, one of the decisions you have to make. What is your goal? Typical goal could be better visibility through app stores, because people go to the iTunes store and they just randomly browse. The reality of that is you will find that if your app is not in the top 20, top 50, it won't be visible at all, really. Do you want to monetize your stuff? So if you want to sell something by selling an item, and that item is obviously a virtual item like an app, you pretty much have to build an app for an app store, because it's the only way to easily sell it. If the stuff you want to sell is a service, let's say a subscription for some website, well, you could still do that, you know, because you have an existing payment mechanism of your web application anyway. Just build a mobile skin for it. Don't bother building an iPhone app. There's not much point in doing that. Then what are your target users? Are your target users like hip, mid-20, mid-30s iPhone users? Are your target users, I don't know, people in the age group of your grandparents? They probably wouldn't use an Android or an iPhone. They would probably have rather an old phone, an old Nokia phone or something. Well, it's just, you know, not discriminating, just experience, really. And where are your target users? That's another question. In Western countries, you'll find that that there are way more people around with smartphones. Doesn't matter which smartphone. In countries like, I don't know, the Philippines, for example, or in some other Southeast Asian countries, or in South America or in Africa, you can't expect many people to have an iPhone, potentially, right? So it totally depends on where you want to deliver that app. Just jump quickly over that, and we'll have a quick chat about app stores. In general, if you never had a look into those app store models, most likely you're not going to be rich. There are a few people who get tremendously rich by selling apps in an app store. But the majority of people will not. And this is not to discourage anyone. It's just, again, the reality, including myself, unfortunately. The general concept of those app stores is you build something, you get into the development program for a platform, you get approval for your app, the app becomes visible in the app store, and you sell it, and there's a revenue share model. General rules, each of those stores has requirements. Some of those stores spit them out quite clearly. Others don't. Apple doesn't, really, to be honest. The Apple app approval process is still rather not transparent. It has become much, much better, but it is some sort of not really clear sometimes why an app doesn't get approval or others do. Common theme is if your app is unstable, if it links to competitor sites, if it has porn content, racist content, stuff like that, it's not going to get approved. When it comes to that objectionable or porn content, as a rule of thumb, if you're building something, for example, in the online dating space, apply moral of conservative US Midwest society. It's just what it is, basically. If you go with something, whatever you do, that would work for someone in, I don't know, Kansas, let's say, then it will get approval. If you build something that is, you know, more daring than that, you might not get your app into the App Store. Just what it is. Some numbers. In the iTunes App Store, Apple basically had a $2.5 billion turnover in US dollars in 2010. It's quite huge. Prediction for 2013, just the App Store of Apple, $6+ billion US dollars turnover. All major platforms together, about $17 to $18 billion. When you think about those figures, that's a small country's gross national product. That's crazy. In the Apple Store, we'll find around 300,000 apps. The Nokia OV Store is about 35 to 40,000, but that is a number that is not really trustworthy because they sell lots of background images and ringtones and sell it as apps, which is not really an app. And the Android market has about 100,000 apps at the moment. The Android market has a huge momentum, though. So if you look at the figures for how many apps per month get added to that app store, your Android market is clearly leading at the moment. Pricing is also quite interesting. The average purchase price in the iTunes store is about $4 US. The average selling price of the top 100 apps is about $2, which basically means that if you want to actually get into the top 100, you rather have to offer it cheap. Otherwise, people are not going to buy it. 45% of all apps are 99 cents, which is the minimum price if you want to charge something in the App Store. 19% are between $1 and $2 US dollars, and just 9% are like high price or high value apps of $7-8 or more. Revenue sharing across all of them is 70-30. So 70% goes to the developer, 30% stays with the app store. The BlackBerry app world is different. They run individual kiosks within the app store and they share 80-20. But then the kiosk owner who gets the 80 keeps another whatever margin of what you actually get. So you get less than 80, and it depends on the particular kiosk how much you get. The interesting question here is, from my point of view, will it stay that way or will it change? Because, I mean, everyone is doing the same thing, right? And it would be interesting to see one particular app store, for example, to go to 85-15. What would people do? You know, would people all of a sudden jump to Android market, say, well, I get 15% more, so maybe I focus on that? Or would Apple maybe, you know, just follow, do the same? I don't know. It's, you know, just very interesting to see that everyone is doing exactly the same thing and no one is daring to make the first move in terms of revenue sharing. That's just a quick overview of the different pricing structures. Basically, all the major stores offer you to sell for free, or the minimum price would be 99 cents US, and they have a maximum limit which is different by store. As a developer, usually you have no rights at all. You have the full liability. You have to agree to overseas legal terms and conditions, which is mostly US-based law, besides actually the Nokia store, that's Finnish law. Have fun with that. That will be interesting. So the story is really marketplaces, they rule the game. They can change the rule at any time. They send you an email. If you don't reply, say you want to quit within 30 days, you accept the new rules, you play the game or you get out, basically. They can punish you. They can give you some sort of penalty payments if customers or too many customers demand refunds of the money. It's not really a developer-friendly game from a legal point of view. So what's the future going to be? That's a quite interesting statistic. And that's quite very recent from last month, where the major platforms are basically compared regarding their market share. And what you'll see is, in 2010, basically Android was leading already with 20-odd%. And that's a really believable number, because compared to 2009, you'll see that Android has made a huge leap, and that is what we all perceive going into Vodafone stores, going into a Virgin store, whatever. You see Android phones all over the place. BlackBerry is coming down a little bit. That's fine. iOS is sort of increasing, but slowly. Symbian is going down the hill really quickly. Windows Phone is prodding along at 5%. No one really cares at this stage. And others are all the others we talked about. The interesting aspect is this, the prediction for 2015. And what we'll see there is iOS is going flat. Symbian has 0.1%, which is probably a few leftover phones that are not broken yet at that time. But Android is nearly at 50%. And I think that is totally believable. The reason is iPhone and iOS is a premium platform and a premium brand. We have to fork out, something between $600 and $1,200 Australian, New Zealand to buy one. Not everyone would want to spend that much money on a phone. So they have reached a level of saturation where people are upgrading iPhones and you get a few new people coming to the iPhone, but there's no massive growth anymore. With Android, it's different. Android is going to be the platform for the masses, from my point of view. What you'll see here is, I found that today. It's an Android 2.2 phone, so it's pretty much the up-to-date operating system version, and you get it for $249 New Zealand dollars. That's about 170 Australian. And that's not with a plan, that's the phone outright, right? So people who offer Android phones have it much easier to get into that low price or lower price mid-market segment. And that's why Android will, in the long run, get to that 50% market share. I have no doubt about that, realistically. Obviously, that phone might have a bit of a slower CPU than others, but still, for the majority of people who want a smartphone, a touchscreen smartphone, which supports apps and Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn and all that stuff, that's fine. That's perfectly fine at the end of the day. What could cause Android to fail? There are a few things. Stupid handset manufacturers, even more stupid network operators, and device fragmentation. And what I mean with that is the fact that only Google phones have the real Android. If you buy an HTC phone, you get Sense. If you buy a Samsung phone, you get whatever the Samsung Android flavor is. If you want to get those phones upgraded, it will be a pain in the neck. An example I have had to deal with myself was basically my Google phone, because I bought it outright from Vodafone in Germany when I was over there visiting my parents last year. And even though it didn't come with a contract, and there was no Vodafone branding in the phone at all, it had a specific version of the Android firmware in that phone, which didn't get any of the Android 2.2 upgrades from Google. Unless Vodafone made the decision, well, now we are ready to release it to our customers. So, that took about 4 months after Google released Android 2.2. 4 months for customization, which comprised nothing visible. No idea what they did, but they didn't do much at least. So I jailbroke my phone about a week after I bought it, because I thought, I live in New Zealand, so if I have warranty on a phone in Germany, how the hell would I get it there anyway? Doesn't really matter. So I got the upgrade right away and it worked perfectly. There's no issue with it, but Vodafone chose to hold back that upgrade for people who bought that Google, exactly the same phone, through them. And that stuff is actually what could cause Android to fail from my point of view, because that is annoying people through the roof. And Apple is very consistent with that, and that's the good thing, basically. So my recommendation, and that's the last slide, really, when you want to build something for mobile, try to leverage your existing skills. Do not focus on a single platform. Don't build something just for iOS. Don't build something just for Android. It's really not giving you the market share you want, most likely. And do not discard cross-platform development because it's not native or something. With cross-platform development nowadays, there's no issue, right? Running Flash on all those phones is fine. Running video in Flash on all those phones is fine. There's no issue. Some people would claim, Flash is sucking so many resources on my Android phone. That's just not true. If you watch a video on a website, which is an HTML5 video, you watch the same video in the Flash player on a website, on your phone, you will see it drains roughly the same amount of resources. It's just watching video on a phone with a battery just, sucks out your battery. That's the reality. It's just what it is at the end of the day. Flash or native or iOS and native, there's not much difference, basically. So that's pretty much it. Go home and build some cool stuff. Thanks a lot for listening.